Morning brings dawn, and dawn a new day. But what if this day was different? What if this day you could see beyond the surface of reality to the essence of creation? Well, come along on a journey to a place where the sun doesn't rise or set, where what you choose is what you get. It's a place that's all around you, but you haven't seen it yet. This is How the Universe Works with Michael Galileo.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another edition of How the Universe Works with Michael Galileo. As Henry Miller said, the world is not out of order. The world is in order, and it is up to us to put ourselves in unison with that order. And looking around us, I know it doesn't seem that way, that the world is in order. It seems like it's out of order. It seems like it's chaos and out of control and going over the edge. But in actuality, the universe is completely in order, and everything is becoming exactly the way that it must. So what's wrong with this picture then, right? Well, that's what we're here to talk about. I am here once again this evening to hold the mantle of truth of how this universe works, to enlighten and inform, because we're all challenged with trying to create the best possible reality we can, the best life experience that we can out of the possibilities that exist in our world. And in order to do that effectively, it helps if you know how the universe works, how the world that we're in operates. And unfortunately, because of the way we've had to figure it out, kind of like learn as you go from the beginning when we became self-aware, again, about 2.5-3 million years ago, it seems that our ability for self-awareness really kicked in and we began to make choices other than the ones that were being made naturally by the universe. And we have subsequently created the karmic world around us, and we are living with the ramifications of that every day and constantly trying to find ways to improve it. And again, if we don't understand how it works, if we're all going to argue about the how and why of things and where they come from and why they're here and who put them here and stuff like that, then we're really not going to get very far. It'd be better if we really could get a grasp of it finally about what's going on here. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to put some puzzle pieces together to help clarify things, to help anyone that may be looking for an explanation of how this universe works that actually holds water, that you can take to the bank, that you can use every day. Like my saying on the wall in front of me says, if your philosophy doesn't grow corn, I don't want to hear about it, said Sun Bear. Well, not sure who Sun Bear was, but I certainly agree with his philosophy. I don't want to hear it. If it doesn't work, if you can't apply it, if you can't count on it, if it doesn't do something for me, don't waste my time with it, because we're all trying to make this world a better place. And anything that causes confusion is something that is evil or harmful and we want to avoid. But what we're looking for is truth. What we're looking for is clarity. What we're looking for is the ability to cut through the illusion of the world around us and be able to see the underlying dynamic that causes it to be the way that it is. That's what we're talking about here. And this week's show, the scheduled theme is Powers of Ten, which once we begin to discuss the Powers of Ten, that's going to be talking about a more or less a visual aspect of reality, the different levels of perspective, let's say, that we can kind of put in such a way that you can follow it almost like a Hansel and Gretel trail. You can go from one edge to the other, from perspective to perspective, and actually see pretty much, not all yet, not quite all. They're working on that. Part of the super collider experiment that's going on over in Europe that is on hold at the moment is partly designed to bring us closer to the bottom edge of the universe. We're only about halfway from where we are to the bottom edge, which is known as Planck's length. And as far as our ability to see the outer edge of our universe. That's the cosmic microwave background and the energy left over from the Big Bang that's vibrating all the way out there, 10 to the positive 24th. And we can pretty much almost see that. We're very close to that with the telescopes and other devices that we have that let us explore distant areas of space. And we're much closer to that edge than we are to the bottom edge, going through the atom. But granted, we did start on the outer edge first. The concept of quantum mechanics and quantum physics is only really, as a science, a very modern evolution of the last couple of hundred years. Before that, most of science was spent looking at the cosmos, looking towards the outer edge, towards the Big Bang, and that's where the efforts really were focused. So it's, of course, no wonder that that's the way we went. And we had to, because the tools that we had available to us at the time, that's really all that it allowed for, to look outward. And once the tools evolved to the point, including time being one of those tools, evolved to the point of being applicable to research on a quantum scale, that's when that work began, and that's the work that's going on to this moment. I just heard today something that I was aware of a few years back, that scientists were working on using DNA to build computer chips because of its ability to transmit information. I mean, how our bodies transmit, I believe it's either 100,000 or 300,000 bits per second of information through our nervous system. That's the speed at which it goes. So they're finding that DNA is actually a very good device for creating computer chips. Now, that, of course, gives us a clue as to how it is that we operate, because we're electric and we process information and we make decisions. We are basically computers. I think somebody has already figured out how to use DNA as part of a computer. That would be the person, that put this universe together. But now, here we are, taking it apart. Lo and behold, Eureka, we have found that, look at that, you can use DNA for processing information. Whoever would have thunk it? But that's what it's been doing since it was created. So we're becoming more familiar with our world, and the more familiar we become with it, the better we can, or the more we can, I won't say better, because that indicates a judgment value, which, of course, we're all doing in every moment with our decisions. But still, it just creates the circumstances for the future to become what it does. So Powers of Ten is a device that we'll talk about in the show tonight that is a visual tool that allows you through the technological advances of computer graphics to be able to see what the perspectives from these areas or at these areas of our universe look like. And collectively, once you see the ladder and the steps from one end to the other, that will help orientate you, the listener, to where we are within the, if you want to call it a matrix, you want to call it a sphere. It's a universe. It's an entity. It's of a relatively fixed size. It metabolizes. It as far as growing and shrinking. When I say fixed size, that I have to clarify that. I don't want to get into that now, so I'll actually take that back because the size moves and changes. But there's a frequency vibration that causes everything to structure the way that it does in the overall shape of the universe. Because of that frequency vibration is that of a dodecahedron, a series of pentagons that line up together to create the shape of the universe, and also creates the shape of your DNA and many other things in nature that are formed at that frequency. And that's what's going on. So we'll talk about the powers of 10. But before we do that, we did not last week, we were talking about time. We were talking about the history of time, how it got invented, how it got created, how it got laid on us as a method, as a tool of coordinating the construct of our reality, which is very simply, that's all it is. That's all it's used for. There are other ways of doing that that don't require the devices that we utilize at this point, but the devices that we utilize at this point work hand-in-hand with the evolution of our continual reality and our future and what advances that that come from that. Because without the ever-increasing accuracies of the tool of time, improving it or making it more accurate so that it can be more finely used to get to greater and greater detail as far as the construct is concerned. And that's what has allowed the ability for the quantum mechanics and quantum physics to take the leaps and the bounds that they are right now. Because without the accuracies of atomic time, we would not be able to go there. There would be no cyberspace. But be that as it may, it took a while to get to the atomic time, which is where most of the world is right now. Not all of the world. There are some countries, third world countries, that do not operate on atomic time. But most of the world does. Even though you still have an analog clock in your house, probably, or just, you know, your digital clock, these things are all being monitored now by atomic time. So things have gotten more accurate and happened step by step. And when we were talking last week, I was reading off of a website that is made available by the government, and the website is called the National Institute of Standards and Technologies, and they have put the, or NSIT, .gov, and they have put together a website that takes us for a walk through time. That's what they call it. And it takes us from ancient calendars to early clocks and all the way up to atomic time. And last week we went through the section of ancient calendars and early clocks. The last one being was a very elaborate clock, mechanized clock in the Far East that used water and different escapements that was very tall and very elaborate. And that's kind of what time they were doing with time at that point. They weren't really advancing the accuracies of the technologies, but they were delivering it in more and more elaborate ways, using water, changing water levels and things like that. Basically the same technology, but in different areas there were different clocks that did different things, basically as decoration, as I say. So, but then from that point on, we moved to the next section, which is called, on the website, it's called The Revolution in Timekeeping. And now we begin to get a little bit closer to the type of timekeeping systems that that we're used to from our childhood and from our existence. Of course, many people today are very much stimulated by digital time, whether it be on their computer screen or the clock that they have, their alarm clock. Digital time really started to become very popular in the 1970s. First, without LEDs. First, it was a little bit of a it was a halfway thing of combining mechanical with digital by having a mechanical device flip down various cards at various times that had the numbers printed on it, kind of like the old-fashioned scoreboards at the old baseball fields. That was the analog to digital leap before we actually got to LED and LCD and things of that nature. But before we get there, I don't want to jump from China in 1300 to atomic time right now. So let's go back to this. And I'm going to read a little bit about this revolution in timekeeping, because I want you to see how what happened was a system of time got layered onto our lifestyles as we moved from an agrarian society and the Industrial Revolution came upon us. And the combination of the mechanical devices of the Industrial Revolution and the invention of incandescent light really gave us a tremendously artificial environment that we are elaborating on and extending and evolving right straight through into cyberspace and the digital world and the digital existence that, that we will experience someday will seem as strange to us, would seem as strange to us today as our artificial life today seems to someone from 1,000 years ago. So, you know, we're kind of in the middle of it. And the revolution in timekeeping went like this. It says, in Europe during most of the Middle Ages, roughly from 500 CE to 1500 CE, technological advancement virtually ceased. For 1,000 years, sundial styles evolved but didn't move far from ancient Egyptian principles, is what we were saying before. During these times, simple sundials placed above doorways were used to identify midday and four tides. They were important times or periods of the sunlit day. By the 10th century, several types of pocket sundials were used. One English model even compensated for seasonal changes of the sun's altitude. Then in the first half of the 14th century, large mechanical clocks began to appear in the towers of central large Italian cities. We have no evidence or record of the working models preceding these public clocks, which were weight-driven and regulated by a verge and foliot escapement. Variations of the verge and foliot mechanism reigned for more than 300 years, but all had the same basic problem. The period of oscillation of the escapement depended heavily on the amount of driving force and the amount of friction in the drive. Like water flow, the rate was difficult to regulate. Another advancement was the invention of spring-powered clocks between 1500 and 1510 by Peter Henlein of Nuremberg, replacing the heavy drive weights permitted smaller and portable clocks and watches. Although they ran slower as the mainspring unwound, they were popular among wealthy individuals due to their small size and the fact that they could be put on a shelf or table instead of hanging on the wall or being housed in tall cases. These advancements in design were precursors to truly accurate timekeeping. So it's closing in on us, around here, 1500 or so, to get more accurate. In 1656, Christian Huygens, a Dutch scientist, made the first pendulum clock regulated by a mechanism with a natural period of oscillation. Galileo Galilei is credited with inventing the pendulum clock concept, and he studied the motion of the pendulum as early as 1582. He even sketched out a design for pendulum clock, but he never actually constructed one before his death in 1642. Huygens' early pendulum clock had an error of less than 1 minute a day, the first time such accuracy had been achieved. His later refinements reduced his clock's error to less than 10 seconds a day. So it's all about the accuracy, closing in on it. Now we're only off by 10 seconds a day. Around 1675, Huygens developed the balance wheel and spring assembly, still found in some of today's wristwatches. This improvement allowed portable 17th century watches to keep time to 10 minutes a day. And in London in 1671, William Clement began building clocks with the new anchor or recoil escapement, a substantial improvement over the verge because it interferes less with the motion of the pendulum. Okay. In 1721, George Graham improved the pendulum's clock's accuracy to 1 second per day. Ooh. A tenfold jump in accuracy. Imagine what tenfold jump would do today. Holy mackerel. He improved the pendulum clock accuracy to 1 second per day by compensating for changes in the pendulum's length due to temperature variations. John Harrison, a carpenter and self-taught clockmaker, refined Graham's temperature compensation techniques and developed new methods for reducing friction. I don't know if anybody's familiar with it, but there is that's the book, basis for the book Longitude by David Sobel. And David Sobel actually has one of my Earth clocks and enjoys it very much. She tells me. Very important fellow here, John Harrison, because that development really changed things as far as being able to direct the sea voyage not to a proper place and avoid people crashing onto the rocks. So a lot to be said for that development. By 1761, he had built a marine chronometer with a spring and balance wheel escapement that won the British government's 1714 prize, worth more than $10 million in today's currency, and that took him a lot of time to work that out, for a means of determining longitude to within 0.5 degree after a voyage to the West Indies. It kept time on board a rolling ship to about 1/5 of a second a day, nearly as well as a pendulum clock could do on land, and 10 times better than required to win the prize. Things happening in tens here. Over the next century, refinements led in 1889 to Sigmund Riefler's clock with a nearly free pendulum, which attained an accuracy of 0.1 of a second a day and became the standard in many astronomical observatories. You see, if you start getting time accurate, you start seeing things, new things. A true free pendulum principle was introduced by R.J. Rudd around 1898, stimulating development of several free pendulum clocks. One of the most famous, the W.H. short clock, was demonstrated in 1921. The short clock almost immediately replaced Riefler's clock as the supreme timekeeper in many observatories. This clock contained two pendulums, one a slave and the other of our master. The slave pendulum gave the master pendulum the gentle pushes needed to maintain its motion and also drove the clock's hand. This allowed the master pendulum to remain free from mechanical tasks that would disturb its regularity. There you go. Then from there, they moved on to quartz clocks, and this is kind of where we come in, which this is the last step before atomic. When they created the quartz clock, says the performance of the short clock was overtaken as quartz crystal oscillators and clocks developed in the 1920s and onward eventually improved timekeeping performance far beyond that achieved using pendulum and balance wheel escapements. Quartz clock operation is based on the piezoelectric property of quartz crystals. Okay, see, here we go. If you apply an electric field to the crystal, it changes its shape. And if you squeeze or bend it, it generates an electric field. When put in a suitable electronic circuit, the interaction between mechanical stress and electric field causes the crystal to vibrate and generate an electrical signal of relative constant frequency that could be used to operate an electronic clock display. So quartz clocks work just like the universe. You have an electrical current that you apply, and depending upon the material and the frequency that you apply, you create a circumstance. In this case, it's time. In the case of the universe, it's time, gravity, hope, and all matter. It's all happening exactly the same way. So, you know, this is not just a history lesson about time. If we can see through time, the nature of time, the way that it's created, the way that it was, it's not real, the way that it's a tool, the way that it's a man-made device, but yet it works the same way as everything else in the universe. And that's really what it comes down to. I mean, everything, everywhere in this universe is working exactly the same way. And everything is happening for exactly the same reason. And it looks like chaos to us, and it looks like confusion, and it looks like things are different, and it looks like everything is happening differently. And ultimately, as it manifests itself in front of our eyes here at 10 to the zero power, which is what we'll be talking about when we come back, we'll wrap up the clocks, and we'll talk about 10 to the zero power, and we're gonna talk about a different aspect of the universe, not the dynamic that causes time, or the tool of time, or the history of time, because that is the all-important aspect of things, how we use time to alter our reality. So we're going to talk about it from a visual standpoint, from a do-you-know-where-you-are standpoint in this universe. The universe is not infinite. This universe has edges. If you go to any self-respecting museum or planetarium, or if you even go online and just key in the keywords to a search engine, a perceivable universe, and what you will find is exactly what I'm talking about. Everything from, we go from Planck's length to the Big Bang, and where, of course, somewhere in the middle of it, we created the system, so we're in the middle, looking out at it, up and down, in and out, and we'll talk about that when we get back. In the meantime, this is Michael Galileo, And we're going to take a little break right now, and I'll see you in a couple of minutes.
A wise man once said, "The world is not to be put in order. The world is in order. It is for us to put ourselves in unison with this order." Most would agree that's easier said than done. Well, getting in line with the universe is about to get a whole lot easier. Join host Michael Galileo Tuesdays at 6 p.m. Pacific Time and become empowered by the knowledge of how our universe works from one edge to the other. You didn't know there are edges? How about where time comes from? No? Wow. See? You do need this show. How the Universe Works with Michael Galileo, here on Contact Talk Radio.
Join Michael Galileo every Tuesday evening at 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And for more information, check out his website at GalileoRealTime.com.
The Buddha and all his successors talk about intellectual structures that confine us to an artificial environment and against concepts that smear over the living fact of things as themselves. So said Robert Aitken, a Zen Buddhist master. Now, with the real-time earth clock, you can pull back the veil of illusion that's helping to cloud truth in your environment. Traditional clocks unknowingly confuse our world with artificial interpretations of time, even going in the opposite direction from which time occurs. The real-time earth clock shows time as it actually happens, and in the process shows us the flow of life on planet Earth. The ultimate feng shui device. It's a totally natural way of looking at time. Want to see a bigger picture? Visit GalileoRealTime.com and click on Clocks. The real-time earth clock. It's time for a new perspective.
Mountain.
musical message from Sam Phillips. A song called Same Rain, which musically says just what I was saying before the break. Everything and everywhere is happening exactly the same way. And the same rain is falling on each and every one of us, and we're all having exactly the same time of it here, just looking at it differently, dealing with it differently, but it's all happening exactly the same way everywhere all the time. And I know it's hard to see that, but that's what we're here for. I'm here to try to help you see that in every way that I possibly can, because once you see that, life becomes a little bit easier to understand, a little bit easier to deal with, a little bit easier to co-create along with the universe in a way that gives us results that we're looking for. And that's what we're trying to do from the moment we're born here. And now we want to talk about where we are in this universe. As I said, that's something that is very well described in a visual aspect of this called Powers of Ten. Now, I don't know how many people are listening with a computer and have the ability within that computer to get online right now, but if you're listening online, you have the ability to get online. If you do, then you could go to the website, you could go to my website, which is GalileoRealTime.com, and click on links. And the first link there talks about something called quarks to quasars. If you go to that website, you'll be able to see what I'm talking about. And I'm having a little technical difficulty right now. I'm getting a little feedback in my... I don't know if that's supposed to be there or not, but I'm hearing myself. But I figured I'd check that out. Okay, that's a little bit better now. I'm in good shape. Sorry for the distraction. But, yes, if you go to my website, GalileoRealTime.com, click on links, you'll see one, Quarks to Quasars, Powers of Ten, and you can go on a visual journey of this universe. And for lack of visual ability to show you everyone over the radio. For those of you that don't have the computer, we'll kind of talk about it a little bit, because this is something that hopefully down the road you'll get a chance to look at online, or you'll be able to go to a planetarium. Many of the major planetariums have something that shows this. Again, it's called our perceivable universe, and that very many of these take you on a step-by-step journey from one edge to the other, which is kind of what the computer program that this fellow has put together has done on the computer. So you don't have to go to the planetarium. But they both show you exactly the same thing, step-by-step, place-by-place, how this universe looks at that particular level. And like I've said before the break, and I've said before, the universe that we're in is shaped like a dodecahedron on its outer edge, and that comes from the frequency vibration causing the material or the matter or the entity or whatever word you want to use that are the basic elements that are then created, that causes the particle accumulation to create matter within our universe, is causing it to shape that way. And it's causing everything to constantly move and change and go from what it was to what it is, just like metal filings to an electromagnet. When you turn the power on, all the filings start lining up. So once the power came onto this universe, back at the Big Bang, that started things in motion, and then after that we had the evolution of the quasars within the universe, which generated great power, which drove the accumulation of matter at a faster rate than it had been up until that point. And then locally we now have stars, which which is what our sun is, which causes the electrical current that basically runs the solar system on a local level, causing everything to be. And all of those power sources are causing everything around them to operate exactly the same way, causing it to go from what it is to what it has to be based upon what it's interacting with it in its environment and that continuous frequency. And that's happening with matter, that's happening with relationships, that's happening with the financial markets, that's happening everywhere all the time. Each thing is constantly changing because each moment is becoming the next, and that's the dynamic that drives everything from what it is to what it must be in what we consider to be a forward direction as relative to our objective perspective that sees things as objects. We see things going from beginnings to ends because we see things as what they are. We don't see the energy that causes it to be what it is at that moment and realize that energy is just changing and will be something else in the next. So as we objectify the universe, it makes it more difficult to actually see the properties below the surface of the thing that is at the moment that is causing it to be that way. But that's where the commonality is, because everything comes from exactly the same place for exactly the same reason, and that's the electromagnetic current that continues to cause this universe to evolve from its state in any moment to its state in the next moment, and that's what's going on. And we as co-creators have the ability to affect that. And it helps if you understand where you are, because it's just, you know, it's a relative thing. And if you see the universe having the outer edge of the dodecahedron, and then if you were to travel, if you can imagine traveling inward from that dodecahedron's outer edge, let's say that's Big Bang, and you travel towards the center of it, and then when you got to the center of it, there was an atom at the center of that, and then you went into that atom, and you continued through that atomic structure to smaller and smaller particles that make up that atom. And yeah, we'll do that now. I'm going to go from the atom down by, I happen to have the page up on my screen, so I'm looking at what we call 10 to the zero power, which is the same thing you're looking at no matter where you're looking, because it's a view of what the perspective is from man in its reality as far as the size of things is concerned. It sees everything around it at the size that we do in relativity. And the concept of 10 to the zero power and the size of that entity is measured by the speed of light and how long a time frame it takes for light to travel across a 1 meter area. So at 10 to the zero power, where we are, it takes light about 3 nanoseconds to cross 1 meter, not 1 meter, but the picture we're looking at, I'm looking at, and others that might be on the same page are looking at. And as we move downward, if I click -1 and I go one step down from that to 10 to the -1, and now where I was looking at a lily pad that looked like a lily pad, I now have a very big close-up of the lily pad, and I see there is a bee on that flower, that's 10 to the -1, and that's approximately 10 centimeters. So, it's again, it's a measurement of the amount of time it takes for light to travel a distance, but really what you're doing is you're seeing smaller and smaller aspects of the same entity just by looking at it and looking within it, looking below the surface. So now I not only see a lily pad, which is all I saw at first at 10 to the zero power, but now when I get down closer to like a bee's perspective, I see the bee and I see the flower there. And then if I go one more and I'm at 10 to the -2, all I see is the bee's head, because it's just we're getting further and further down. The next step down is I see the bees, just the eye, as a screen and elements of that eye. And at 10 to the -4, I am down where a piece of pollen is the same size that the lily pad was in my first picture, and I'm only down four steps, and a piece of pollen is that large or that small if we were to travel down it, kind of like Alice going down the looking, you know, down the hole as we go inside that atom. Now, remember, we started this journey all the way out at the outer edge of a dodecahedron, the Big Bang, the edge of the universe, and we've traveled inward through that to the center where there was an atom, and then through that atom where we go further down. So, you know, here I am at the size of pollen at 10 to the negative fourth, and then I'm down at bacteria, size of a bacteria within that pollen at 10 to the negative fifth. Then I'm down to the size of a virus on a bacteria at 10 to the negative sixth. At 10 to the negative 7th, I'm down to the virus itself. The size of the virus in this picture is basically the size of the lily pad in the first picture, going down seven steps in progression on this scale to help us use a ladder to travel the universe visually from one edge to the other, trying to get a bird's eye and a virus's eye view of things. We go down another step at 10 to the negative 8. We're in DNA within a virus. You begin to see, it says at this scale, individual atoms have become visible. So we're not even to the atom yet. We're still traveling to the atom, right, from the outer edge of the universe. This image represents the packed nucleic acids, either DNA or RNA, but not both, that form the reproductive core of viruses. The double helix structure of DNA is clearly visible. When the virus invades a living cell, the virus's DNA takes over the cellular mechanisms of the host to make more copies of itself. So here we are, 10 to the negative 8th, and we're closing in on DNA. And then you see the actual structure, representation. You're right down in there. The atom in the center of the square is a carbon atom. Now I'm looking at a carbon atom. There's the carbon atom outer shell at 10 to the negative 10th. You know, and this is like taking a journey through space. It's amazing what you can see. At 10 to the negative 11th, we're at the inner electron cloud. And if you take this journey from one edge to the other, you'll see that now it's starting to look like outer space because all you're seeing is a lot of different particles. This image represents the cloud of charge of the two inner electrons of the carbon atom. That's all it is, and it looks just like stars in outer space. But now we're in the inner electron cloud at 10 to the negative 11th. At 10 to the negative 12th, approaching the nucleus of a carbon atom, and it looks like a planet, a lone planet in the dark out in space. We're closing in on it and then going the opposite direction. We approach the nucleus at 10 to the negative 13th. It's a carbon atom. It contains a tightly bound group of 6 protons and 6 neutrons. And that's what we're looking at here, and you can see it. There's the total nucleus at 10 to the negative 14th. You see it all. You see it looks like a bunch of balls all stuck together, and they are. They're held together by the electromagnetic current that's causing it all to attract. At 10 to the negative 14th, it's really visible as a nucleus. And now we're inside it. We're at a proton at 10 to the negative 15th. And then we hit inside a proton at 10 to the negative 16th. Planck's constant, the speed of light. We're getting there. But it's at 10 to the negative 35th. Furthest we go down visually, and this is quarks and gluons at 10 to the negative 17th. That's how far we go. But it goes all the way down to 10 to the negative 35th. So going inside the atom, we still have not seen or even can even visualize to create through computer graphics to represent what we know through information. What we have from 10 to the negative 17th or so, all the way to 10 to the negative 35th. So we're only halfway down to the bottom edge of everything in this universe. Because no matter where you started at the outer edge of the universe, when you get to that, no matter where you are, you get to every atom. And within every atom, you'll find the bottom edge of the universe. It's almost like back in the day, there was a game called the Super Mario Brothers, and part of the the mystery of that game was that there were secret doors that would open up, and there were, you could go from one level to another level if you knew where those doors were and escape danger and arrive someplace safely, or if you weren't watching where you were going, you could arrive in danger by going through that door. I'm not saying that there's danger or safety on the other side of that 10 to the negative 35th length that we seem to believe is Planck's length, or the smallest that anything can actually be in this universe before it no longer is in this universe, and does not, as far as we know, subject itself to the laws of this, the law of this universe, because there is only one. There really is only one, you know, and it's a math formula. It goes UN equals UN minus 1 plus UN minus 2. The Fibonacci recurrent series of whole numbers. It's also known as the golden ratio, the golden mean. It actually happens to be the subject of next week's show. We will talk about that proportion and how that proportion, along with the electromagnetic frequency that causes that proportion and the matter that it affects, causes everything to be the way that it is around here. And it all starts down there at around 10 to the negative 35th. And because of the continual electrical current, it builds itself step by step from that lowest point up to the point where we can now begin to visualize it at 10 to the negative 18th, and then come all the way up and see a thing at 10 to the zero power right here, right around you, whether it's the telephone or the computer or a pen or a clock or whatever it might be, a relationship, a business, a corporation, the weather. It really doesn't matter, because everything everywhere happens for exactly the same reason. And the question that we have as human beings is, what are we doing about it? I'm not even saying we should be doing something about it, but that's the question we have as human beings. What are we doing about it? And the result of our life every day, our choices every day, is what manifests here at 10 to the zero power. Because as things go from all the way down at the bottom to where they are right now, that's where we affect things, by seeing the different possibility that exists in every second. And that's why we talk about time here as being a compilation of 18.5-mile-long seconds. And each one, like snowflakes, has different possibilities than the one before it and the one after it. And depending upon what your choice is among those possibilities, the subsequent moments and the reality around you grows and becomes as it must and does. And if it doesn't grow and become as you would like it to be, it's not the universe's fault. The universe is giving you exactly what you're asking for with the circumstances that you're in and the work and the material that you're working with. It is causing each moment to become the next logically, in sequence, without mystery, giving you a wonderful environment to construct a reality. It's like giving you each second is like a building block. Okay, there's a building block. Okay, there's a building block. And the question is, what are we building with our choices? And the answer is everything around us. And the universe is giving it to us, and we're creating it. And if we don't like it, we don't blame the universe. Okay, we take a look at the choices and how they are manifesting themselves and what can be done differently. And that takes dealing with truth. And that's one of the reasons I created the Earth Clock, which you may have heard me mention here, which is you can view on my website. And also, I just posted yesterday, well, I didn't post, someone posted a video, a short video of the prototype of my year-long Earth Clock on Facebook. So if you want to see that, you could go to my Facebook page, which you can connect to from my website, or just if you're on Facebook, it's I'm Michael Galileo. You can check out my site, and you can see the video of the year-long Earth Clock. So you can take a look at it there. And that hopefully we'll be able to get into production. Right now I just have the prototype, but we're working on it, working on a large one of those as well. So you might want to take a look at the clocks, because, you know, what we were talking about, all this time stuff, and we got the quartz clocks. Now that is the most, that's the mechanism I use to drive my clock. After quartz, we go to atomic. I'm not really interested at this point, because what I'm trying to do is just help us keep a little relativity to the natural world around us through the Earth Clock. So if you're interested, please check it out. The Dalai Lama likes his. David Sobel likes hers. Andy Rooney talked about it on 60 Minutes a couple of times, which you can find on the 60 Minutes website if you want to go take a look at that. They say any publicity is good publicity, so of course we know Andy's a little curmudgeon, so of course he had some fun with it. And that's what it's intended for. It's intended to have fun. So check it out. Take a look at it. Anybody has any questions, get in touch. Otherwise, we're going to wrap it up, do a little bit of the Sam Phillips on the way out, and I will see you folks next week. If you need to get in touch, give me a shout at my website, email, and I look forward to seeing you next week to talk to you more about how the universe works. Okay, I'll see you next week. Take care.
Been listening to How the Universe Works with Michael Galileo. If you have a question about anything that has been discussed on this show, feel free to drop us a line at contacttalkradio.com or visit www.galileorealtime.com. The views expressed by host Michael Galileo may not be that of this station, but they are certainly correct. Warning, the power generated by the knowledge expressed on this show may transform your life, and you should definitely try it at home. Tune in next week for another edition of How the Universe Works with Michael Galileo.